The book is good, yes? Pasquale's mother had never liked Alvis Bender as much as Pasquale and his father did. If the man was such a brilliant writer, she said, why had he only written one chapter in 8 years? It's sad, Dee said, and she put her hand on her chest. Pasquale couldn't look away from those lovely fingers splayed out over the tops of Dee Morey's breasts. I am sorry, he cleared his throat. You find this sad story in my hotel. Oh, no, it's very good, she said. It has a kind of hopelessness that made me feel less alone in my own hopelessness. Does that make sense? Pasquale nodded unsurely. The movie I was working on, Cleopatra, it's about how destructive a force love can be. But maybe that's what every story is about. She removed her hand from her chest. Pasquale, have you ever been in love? He felt himself flinch. Yes. What was her name? Amedea, he said, and he wondered how long it had been since he'd said Amedea out loud. He was amazed at the power it had, that simple name. Do you still love her? Of all the difficulties of speaking in another language, this one was the worst. Yes, Pasquale finally said. Why aren't you with her? Pasquale exhaled, surprised at the sharpness of the base of his ribs. He finally just said, "It's not simple, no?" "No," she said, and looked out to a tight roll of white clouds just beginning to pearl on the horizon. "It's not simple." "Come, one more thing." Pasquale moved to the far corner where the bunker met the jagged boulders of the cliff face. He pulled away branches and pushed rocks aside, revealing a narrow rectangular hole in the concrete roof. He squeezed in and lowered himself down. Halfway into the pillbox, he looked across its roof to see that Dee still hadn't moved. "He's safe," Pasquale said. "He's okay. Come." He dropped into the bunker, and a moment later Dee Morey squeezed through the narrow hole and dropped in next to him. It was dark inside, the air a bit stale, and in the corners they had to stoop a bit to avoid hitting their heads on the concrete ceiling. The only light came from the three gun turrets, which, in the early morning, cast distorted rectangles of light on the pillbox floor. "Look," Pasquale said, and he pulled a matchbox from his pocket, struck a single kitchen match, and held it to one of the concrete walls in the back of the bunker. Dee walked toward the flickering light of the match. The back wall was covered with paintings. 5 frescoes, immaculately painted on the concrete, one after the other, as if it were a crude gallery wall. Pasquale lit another match and handed it to her, and she stepped even closer to the wall. The artist had painted what looked like wooden frames around the paintings, too. And even though they had been done on concrete and the paint was faded and cracked, it was clear the artist had real talent. The first was a seascape, the rough coast beneath this very pillbox, the churning waves on the rocks, Porto Vergogna, just a cluster of rooftops in the right-hand corner. The next two were official-looking portraits of 2 very different German soldiers. And finally, there were 2 identical paintings of a single girl. Time and weather had faded the colors to dull versions of some earlier vibrancy, and a stream of water seeping into the bunker had damaged the seascape, while a large crack split one of the soldiers' portraits, and a fissure ran through the corner of the first painting of the girl. But otherwise, the art was remarkably well preserved. "Later, the sun, it come through these windows," Pasquale pointed to the machine gun slots in the pillbox wall. "Make this paint. It seem alive. The girl, she is molto bella, yes?" Dee stared, open-mouthed. "Oh, yes." Her match went out, and Pasquale lit another. He put a hand on Dee's shoulder and pointed to the 2 paintings in the center, the portraits of the 2 soldiers. "The fishermen say 2 German soldiers live here in the war, for guard the sea, yes? When he painted this wall. She stepped in closer to look at the soldiers' portraits. One a young, chinless boy with his head cocked proudly, looking off to the side, tunic buttoned to his chin. The other a few years older, shirt open, staring straight out from the wall. And even with the paint faded on the concrete, an unmistakable wistful look on his face. "This one was the painter," she said quietly. Pasquale bent in close. "How do you know this?" "He just looks like an artist, and he's staring at us. He must have looked in a mirror as he painted his own face." Dee turned, took a few steps, and looked out the gun turret to the sea below. Then she turned back to the paintings. "It's amazing, Pasquale. Thank you." She covered her mouth as if about to cry, and then she turned to him. "Imagine being this artist, creating masterpieces up here that no one will ever see. I think it's kind of sad." She returned to the painted wall. Pasquale lit another match, handed it to her, and she made her way down the wall again. The roiling sea on the rocks, the two soldiers, and finally two paintings of the girl, sitting three-quarters sideways, painted from the waist up, two classic portraits. Dee paused over these last paintings. Pasquale had always assumed the two portraits of the girls were identical. But Dee said, "Look, this one wasn't quite right. He corrected it. From a photograph, I'll bet." Pasquale stepped in beside her. Dee pointed. "In this one, her nose is a little too angled, and her eyes dip." "Yes," Pasquale could see. "She was right. He must have loved her very much," she said. She turned, and in the flickering matchlight, Pasquale thought she might have tears in her eyes. "Do you think he made it home to see her?" They were close enough to kiss. "Yes," Pasquale whispered. "He see her again." Stooped over in the tight pillbox, Dee blew out the match, stepped forward, and hugged him. In the dark, she whispered, "God, I hope so." At 4 in the morning, Pasquale was still thinking about the moment in the dark bunker. Should he have kissed her? He had kissed only one other woman in his life, Amedea, and technically she had kissed him first. He might have tried, if not for the humiliation he still felt about the tennis court. Why hadn't it occurred to him that balls would fly off the cliff? Maybe because in the pictures he'd seen, there were no photos of the balls getting past the players. Still, he felt foolish. He had imagined tennis as something purely aesthetic. He hadn't wanted a tennis court. He'd wanted a painting of a tennis court. Obviously, without offense, the players themselves could run right off the court and fall over the cliff into the sea. Dee More was right. A high fence could be erected easily enough. And yet he knew that a high fence would ruin the vision he'd always had, of a flat court hovering over the sea, rising from the cliffside boulders. A perfect, cantilevered shelf covered with players in white clothes, women sipping drinks under parasols. If they were behind fences, you wouldn't see them from the approaching boats. Chain fences would be better, but would cloud the player's view of the sea and would be ugly, like a prison. Who wanted a brutto tennis court? That night, the man Dee More was waiting for didn't come, and Pasquale felt somehow responsible, as if his little wish that the man would drown had been upgraded to a prayer and had come true. Dee More had retreated to her room at dusk, and in the early morning had gotten violently ill again, and could only get out of bed to vomit. When there was nothing left in her stomach, tears rolled from her eyes, and her back arched, and she sniffed and slumped to the floor. She didn't want Pasquale to see her wretch, and so he sat in the hallway and reached his hand around the corner, through the doorway, to hold her hand. Pasquale could hear his aunt stirring downstairs. Dee took a long breath. "Tell me a story, Pasquale. What happened when the painter returned to the woman?" "They marry and have 50 children."
50?
"Maybe 6. He became a famous painter, and every time he paint a woman, he paint her. De Moray vomited again, and when she could speak, said, "He's not coming, is he?" It was odd and intimate, their hands connected, their heads in different rooms. They could talk, they could hold hands, but they couldn't see each other's faces. "He's coming," Pasquale told her. She whispered, "How do you know, Pasquale?" "I know, but how?" He closed his eyes and concentrated on the English, whispering back around the corner, "Because if you wait for me, I crawl on my knees from Rome to see you." She squeezed his hand and retched again. The man didn't come that day either, and as much as he wanted to keep De Moray for himself, Pasquale began to get angry. What kind of man sent a sick woman to a remote fishing village and then left her there? He thought of going to La Spezia and using a phone to call the Grand Hotel, but he wanted to look this bastard in his cold eye. "I go to Rome today," he told her.
"No, Pasquale, it's okay. I can just go on to Switzerland when I feel better. Maybe he left word for me there."
"I must go to Rome anyway," he lied. "I find this Michael Dean and tell him you wait here." She stared off a moment and then smiled.
"Thank you, Pasquale."
He left precise instructions to Valeria for the care of the American. "Let her sleep, and don't make her eat anything she doesn't want to eat, and don't lecture her about her skimpy nightclothes. If she gets sick, send for Dr. Merlonghi." Then he peeked in on his mother, who lay awake waiting for him.
"I will be back tomorrow, Mamma," he said.
"It will be good for you," she said, "to have children, with such a tall, healthy woman with such breasts."
He asked Tommaso the Communist to motor him to La Spezia, so he could take a train to Florence, then on to Rome to scream at Michael Dean, this awful man who had abandoned an ailing woman this way.
"I should go to Rome with you,"
Tommaso said as they cut across a light chop and made their way south. Tommaso's little outboard motor chugged in the water and whined when it came out as he piloted from the back, squinting along the shoreline while Pasquale crouched in front.
"These American movie people, they're pigs."
Pasquale agreed.
"To send a woman off and then forget about her."
"They mock true art," Tommaso said. "They take the full sorrow of life and make a circus of fat men falling into cream pies. They should leave the Italians alone to make films. But instead, their stupidity spreads like a whore's disease among sailors. Commedia all'italiana. Bah!"
"I like the American westerns," Pasquale said. "I like the cowboys."
"Bah!"
Tommaso said again. Pasquale had been thinking about something else.
"Tommaso, Valeria says that no one dies in Porto Vergogna except babies and old people. She says the American won't die as long as she stays here."
"Pasquale."
"No, I know, Tommaso. It's just old witch talk. But I can't think of a single person who has died young here."
Tommaso adjusted his cap as he thought.
"How old was your father?"
63, Pasquale said.
"That's young to me," Tommaso said.
They motored toward La Spezia, weaving among the big canning ships in the bay.
"Have you ever played tennis, Tommaso?" Pasquale asked.
He knew Tommaso had been held for a while in a prison camp near Milan during the war, and had been exposed to many things.
"Certainly, I've watched it."
"Do the players miss the ball often?"
"The better players don't miss so much, but every point ends with someone missing, or hitting it into the net, or over the line. There's no way to avoid it."
On the train, Pasquale was still thinking about tennis. Every point ended with someone missing. It seemed both cruel and, in some way, true to life. It was curious what trying to speak English had done lately to his mind. It reminded him of studying poetry in college, words gaining and losing their meaning, overlapping with images, the curious echo of ideas behind the words people used. For instance, when he had asked Dee Morey if the man she loved felt the same way, she had answered quickly that yes, the man loved himself as well. It was such a delightful joke, and his pride in understanding it in English had felt so strangely significant. He just wanted to keep repeating the little exchange in his head, and talking about the paintings in the pillbox. It was thrilling to see what she imagined, the lonesome young soldier with the photograph of the girl. In his train car, two young women were sitting next to each other, reading two copies of the same movie magazine, leaning into each other and chattering about the stories they read. Every few minutes, one of them would glance up at him and smile. The rest of the time, they read their magazines together. One would point to a picture of a movie star in the magazine, and the other would comment on her.
Brigitte Bardot. She's beautiful now, but she will be fat.
They spoke loudly, perhaps to be heard over the sound of the train. Pasquale looked up from his cigarette and surprised himself by asking the women,
"Is there anything in there about an actress named Di More?"
The women had been trying to get his attention for an hour. Now they looked at each other, and then the taller one answered,
"Is she British?"
"American. She is in Italy making the film Cleopatra. I don't think she is a big star, but I wondered if there was anything in the magazines about her."
"She is in Cleopatra?"
the shorter woman asked, and then flipped through her magazine until she found a picture of a stunningly beautiful dark-haired woman, certainly more attractive than Di More, which she held up for Pasquale to see.
"With Elizabeth Taylor?"
The headline beneath Elizabeth Taylor's photo promised details of the shocking American scandal.
"She broke up the marriage between Eddie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds," confided the taller woman.
"So sad. Debbie Reynolds," said the other girl. "She has two babies."
"Yes, and now Elizabeth Taylor's leaving Eddie Fisher, too. She and the British actor Richard Burton are having an affair."
"Poor Eddie Fisher."
"Poor Richard Burton, I think. She's a monster. Eddie Fisher flew to Rome to try to win her back. His wife has two babies. It's shameful."
Pasquale was amazed at how much these women knew about the movie people. It was as if they were talking about their own family, not some American and British movie actors they'd never met. The women were bouncing back and forth, chattering about Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton now. Pasquale wished he'd gone on ignoring them. Had he honestly expected them to know Di More? She'd told Pasquale that Cleopatra was her first film. How would these women have heard of her?
"That Richard Burton is a hound. I would not even give him a second look."
"Yes, you would."
She smiled at Pasquale.
"Yes, I would."
The women cackled.
"Elizabeth Taylor has been married 4 times already,"
the taller woman said to Pasquale, who would have jumped off the train to get out of this conversation. They went back and forth like a tennis match in which neither player missed.
"Richard Burton's been married too," the other woman said. "She's a snake. A beautiful snake. Her actions make her common. Men see through such things. Men see only her eyes. Men see tits. She's common. She can't be common with those eyes. It is scandalous. They act like children, these Americans."
Pasquale pretended to have a coughing fit.
"Excuse me," he said.
He stood and left the chattering car, coughing, pausing to glance out the window. They were nearing the station at Lucca, and he caught a glimpse of the brick and marble Duomo. Pasquale wondered if, when the train got to Florence, he would have enough time before his transfer to take a walk. In Florence, Pasquale lit a cigarette and leaned on the wrought-iron fence in the Piazza Massimo d'Azeglio, down the street and across from Amedea's house. They would have just finished dinner. This was when Amedea's father liked the whole family to go for a walk. Bruno, his wife, and his 6 beautiful daughters, unless he'd married one off in the 10 months that Pasquale had been away from Florence, moving in a cluster down the street, once around the piazza, and then back to their house. Bruno took great pride in parading his girls, like horses at auction, Pasquale always thought, the old man's big bald head tilted back, that deep serious frown on his face. The sun had broken through at dusk, after a day of clouds, and the whole city seemed to be out strolling. Pasquale smoked, watching the couples and families until, sure enough, After a few minutes, the Montelupo girls rounded the corner, Amedea and the two youngest of her sisters. There were three other girls between the young ones and the oldest, Amedea, but they must have been married off. Pasquale held his breath when he saw Amedea. She was so lovely. Bruno came around the corner next with Mrs. Montelupo, who pushed the baby stroller. When he saw the stroller, Pasquale let out the breath he'd taken in a deep sigh. So there it was. He was leaning on the same post he had to lean against when he and Amedea had started seeing one another. He would stand there to signal her. He felt his chest flutter as it used to back then, and that's when she looked up, saw him, stopped suddenly, and reached out for the wall. Pasquale wondered if she looked at their post every day, even now. Unaware of his presence, Amedea's sisters moved on without her. Then Amedea resumed walking too. Pasquale removed his hat, the second part of their old signal. Across the street, he saw Amedea shake her head, no. Pasquale put his hat back on. The three girls walked in front, Amedea with little Donata and Francesca. Behind them strolled Bruno and his wife and the baby in the carriage. A young couple stopped to gaze in at the baby. Their voices carried across the piazza to Pasquale.
"He's so big, Maria," said the woman. "He should be. He eats as much as his father."
Bruno laughed proudly.
"Our hungry little miracle," he said.
The woman reached into the carriage to pinch the baby's cheek.
"You leave some food for your sisters, little Bruno."
Amedea's sisters had turned to watch the couple praise the baby, but Amedea kept her gaze forward, staring across the street as if Pasquale would disappear unless she kept him in her vision. Pasquale had to look away from Amedea's stare. The woman, admiring little Bruno, turned to Amedea's youngest sister, who was 12.
"And do you like having a baby brother, Donata?"
She said she did. They settled into a more intimate conversation. After that, Pasquale could hear only bits from across the street. About the rains, how warm weather seemed to be lurking around a corner. Then the couple moved on, and the Montelupos finished their lap around the piazza and were devoured, one by one, by the tall wooden door of their narrow house, which Bruno ceremoniously pulled shut behind them. Pasquale stood there smoking. He checked his watch. Plenty of time before the last train to Rome. 10 minutes later, Amedea came striding across the street, her arms crossed as if she were cold. He had never been able to read her lovely brown eyes beneath their black brows. They were so fluid, so naturally teary that even when she was angry, which was often, her eyes always seemed ready to forgive.
"Bruno?"
Pasquale said when Amedea was still several strides away.
"You let them name him Bruno?"
She walked right up to him.
"What are you doing here, Pasquale?"
"I wanted to see you.
And him. Can you bring him to me?"
"Don't be stupid." She reached up and took the cigarette from his hand, dragged on it, and blew the smoke from the side of her mouth. He'd almost forgotten how small Amedea was, so wiry and lithe. She was 8 years older than him, and she carried herself with a mysterious, animal-like sensual ease. He still felt dizzy around her, the matter-of-fact way she used to drag him by the hand to his apartment. His roommate was gone during the day. Push him down on the bed, undo his pants, lift her skirt, and settle herself on him. His hands would go to her waist, his eyes would lock hers, and Pasquale would think, "This is the whole of the world here."
"Can't I at least see my boy?"
Pasquale said again.
"Maybe in the morning when my father is at his office." "I'm not going to be here in the morning. I'm taking the train to Rome tonight."
She nodded, but didn't say anything.
"So you just pretend he is your brother? And no one thinks it's strange that your mother has another baby, 12 years after her last child?"
Amedea answered wearily,
"I have no idea what they think.
Papa sent me to live with my mother's sister in Ancona, and they told people that I was caring for her because she was sick. My mother dressed in pregnancy clothes, and then told people she was going to Ancona to deliver. After a month, we came back with my baby brother.
She shrugged, as if it were all nothing.
Miracle. Pasquale didn't know what to say. How was it? Having a baby?
She looked away.
It was like shitting a hen.
She looked back and smiled.
Now it's not so bad. He's a sweet baby. When everyone is asleep, I sometimes hold him and tell him quietly, I am your mamma, little baby.
She gave a little shrug of her shoulders.
Other times I almost forget and believe that he's my brother.
Pasquale felt sick again.
It was as if they were talking about an idea, an abstraction, and not a child. Their child.
This is insane. To be acting this way in 1962? It's wrong.
Even as he said this, he knew it must sound ridiculous, since he was taking no part in raising the baby. Amedea said nothing, just stared at him and then removed a bit of tobacco from her tongue.
I tried marrying you,
Pasquale almost said, but thought better of it. She would only have laughed, of course, having been there for his proposal. Amedea had been engaged once before when she was 17, to the prosperous but frog-eyed son of her father's partner in his real estate holding firm. When she balked at marrying a man twice her age, her father was furious. She had dishonored the family, and if she would not marry this perfectly good suitor, then she would never marry. She had two choices: go off to a convent, or stay in the house and care for her aging parents and whatever children her married sister bore.
Fine, Amedea said. She'd be the family nursemaid. She didn't need a husband.
Later, irritated by her defiant, surly presence around the house, her father allowed her to get a secretarial job at the university. She'd worked there for 6 years, cutting the loneliness by taking an occasional faculty lover when, at 27, she went for a walk and came across 19-year-old Pasquale studying on the banks of the Arno. She stood above, and when he looked up, she smiled down at him and said,
Hello, eyes.
From the first, he was wildly attracted to her thin, restless energy, her subversive, quick wit. That first day, she asked him for a cigarette, but he said he didn't smoke.
I walk by here every Wednesday, she said, in case you want to start.
A week later, she walked by and Pasquale leaped to his feet and offered her a cigarette, his hands shaking as he pulled the pack from his pocket. He lit her cigarette and she gestured at the open books on the ground, a book of poems and an English dictionary. He explained that he'd been assigned to translate the poem Amore e Morte.
The great Leopardi, she said,
and bent to pick up his notebook. She read what he'd translated so far.
Fratelli, a un tempo stesso, amore e morte, ingenerò la sorte.
Brothers, the time is same, love and death engendered sorts.
Good job, she said. You've cured that song of its music.
She handed him back the notebook, said,
Thank you for the cigarette,
and walked on. The next week, when Amadea walked by the river, Pasquale was waiting with a cigarette and his notebook, which she took without a word, and read aloud in English,
Brothers of a single breath, born together, love and death.
She handed him back the notebook, smiled, and asked if he had an apartment nearby. Within 10 minutes she was tugging at his pants, the first girl he'd ever kissed, let alone slept with. They met in his apartment 2 afternoons a week during the next 18 months. They never spent a night together, and she explained that she would never go out in public with him. She was not his girlfriend, she insisted. She was his tutor. She would help with his studies and train him to be a good lover, give him advice about how to talk to girls, how to approach them, what to avoid saying. When he insisted he didn't want other girls, he wanted only her, she laughed. She also laughed at his early awkward attempts to make conversation.
How can those beautiful eyes have so little to say? She coached him to make eye contact, to breathe deeply, and to consider his words, not answer so quickly. Of course, his favorite lessons were those she gave on his mattress on the floor. How to use his hands, how to avoid finishing too quickly. After a few successful lessons, she fell off him one day and said, "I'm quite the teacher. How lucky for the woman you're going to marry." For him, these afternoons were dizzying and liquid, and he'd have continued that way the rest of his life, going to class and knowing that twice a week, the lovely Amedea was coming to teach him. Once, after an especially intimate encounter, he made the mistake of saying, "Ti amo. I love you." And she pushed him away angrily, stood, and began getting dressed. "You can't just say that, Pasquale. Those words have tremendous power. It's how people end up married." She pulled on her blouse. "Don't ever say that after sex, do you understand? If you feel the urge to say it, go see the girl first thing in the morning, with her night breath and no makeup. Watch her on the toilet. Listen to her with her friends. Go meet her hairy mother and her shrill sisters. And if you still feel the need to say such a stupid thing, then God help you." She told him so often that he didn't really love her, that it was just a reaction to his first sexual experience, that she was too old for him, that they were all wrong for each other, that they were of different classes, that he needed a girl his own age. And she was so assured in her opinions that Pasquale had no reason to doubt her. And then, one fateful day, she came to his apartment and said, without preamble, "I'm pregnant." What followed was an awful pause, as Pasquale experienced a moment of misunderstanding. Did she say pregnant? Followed by a moment of disbelief. But we almost always took precautions. And another moment when he waited for her to tell him what to do, as she usually did, so that by the time he came around to speaking, "I think we should get married." So much time had passed, the proudly defiant Amedea could only laugh in his face. "Così ragazzo. Such a boy. Had he learned nothing? Did he really believe she would let him throw his life away like that? And even if he really wanted to, which he clearly didn't, did he actually think that she would ever marry a penniless boy from a peasant village? Did he really believe that her father would allow such shame upon his family? And even if her father approved, and he would never approve, did he really think she would ever make a husband of such an aimless, unformed boy? A boy she had seduced out of boredom? The last thing the world needed was another bad husband. On and on she went, until Pasquale could only mutter, "Yes, you're right," and believe it. This had always been the mechanics of their attraction, her sexual seniority and his childlike agreeability. She was right, he thought. He couldn't raise a child. He was a child. Now, almost a year later, in the piazza across from her family's big house, Amedea smiled wearily and reached for his cigarette again. "I was sorry to hear about your father. How is your mother?" "Not good. She wants to die." Amedea nodded. "It's the hardest thing to be a widow, I would think. I've thought about coming to visit your pensione sometime. How is it?" "Good. I'm building a beach. I was going to build a tennis court, but it might not fit." He cleared his throat. I have an American guest there. An actress." "From the cinema?" "Yes. She's making the film Cleopatra." "Not Liz Taylor?" "No, another one." She took the tone she used to have when she was advising him about other girls. "And is she beautiful?" Pasquale acted as if he hadn't thought about it until now. "Not much." Amedea held out her hands like she was holding cantaloupes. "But big breasts, no? Giant balloons. Pumpkins?" Her hands moved away from her body. "Zeppelins?" "Amedea," he said simply. She laughed at him. "I always knew you'd be a big success, Pasquale." Was that mocking, her tone?
She tried to hand his cigarette back, but he waved it over to her and pulled out a new one for himself. And they stood there smoking their separate cigarettes, not talking, until Amadeus was all ash, and she said she had to get back inside. Pasquale said he had to catch his train anyway.
"Good luck with your actress," Amadeus said,
and she smiled as if she meant it. Then she darted in her light way across the street, glanced back at him once, and walked off. Pasquale felt an itch in his throat, the urge to yell something after her. But he kept his mouth shut, because he had no idea what those words might be. Chapter 7 Eating Human Flesh 1846, Truckee, California. So there's this guy, a carriage maker named William Eddy, good family man, handsome, honest, but uneducated. It's 1846, and William is married with two little kids. But he's dirt poor, so when the opportunity comes to go to California to make his fortune, Eddy jumps at it. It's the driving ambition of his time, his people, to go west. So Eddy signs on with a wagon train leaving Missouri for California. Over credits, this William Eddy and his pretty young wife are getting ready for the journey, packing up their meager belongings from their sod and log cabin. The camera makes its way down a long line of wagons, filled with all of their belongings, herds of cattle moving with them, strung out for a half mile leading out of town, kids and dogs running alongside. On the front of the wagon train we see California or bust. Swing around to the other side of this wagon and we see Donner Party. The trains were always named for the prominent families, but William Eddy's the closest thing to a decent frontiersman on this particular train. Good hunter and tracker, humble to a fault. The first night out, the men from the wealthy families meet to discuss the trip, and William steps to the fire to say that he's worried. They've gotten a late start, and he's not sure about this route they're taking. But he's hushed by the wealthier guys, and he just goes back to his ragtag wagon in the back of the train. The first act is all action, descent, trouble. Right away, the pioneers hit bad weather and wagon wheels breaking. There's a villain in the party, a sturdy German immigrant named Kesseberg, who scammed an old couple into joining his wagon, but when they're out past civilization, Kesseberg steals everything from the old people and turns them out, forcing them to walk. Only William Eddy takes the couple in. The wagon train arrives in Utah at the halfway point, strung out weeks behind schedule. At night, the party's cattle are scavenged by Indians. William Eddy is the best hunter, so he kills game along the way. But bad luck and bad weather continue to plague them, and they have to pay for taking this questionable route when everything breaks down on the Great Salt Flats. We pan over this cracked, hard soil, a trail of wagons strung out for miles, cattle starting to fall dead, the settlers forced to stagger across a desert, family by family, horses walking blindly, the foreshadowing of the dissolution of society, everyone turning slightly feral except William Eddy, who retains his human dignity to help the rest of the party get across. Finally, they make it to Nevada, but it's October, weeks later than any group of pioneers has ever tried to make it through. The snows usually come in mid-November, so they still got a few weeks to cross the Sierra Nevada range at the Wasatch Mountain Pass, and they'll be in California. But they must hurry. They walk and ride all night hoping to make it. Now we're up in the clouds, but these aren't fluffy clouds. They're dark and ominous, black masses of foreboding. This is our Jaws, and these clouds are our shark. We're tight on a single snowflake. We follow it down through the sky and see it joined by other flakes, big, heavy. We watch that first flake fall, finally coming to rest on the arm of William Eddy. Dirty and unshaven. And he knows. His eyes go slowly to the sky. They are too late. The snows have come a month early. The Donner Party is already in the mountains, and the snow is blinding. Not just flakes. Curtains of snow fall, making the passage more than difficult. It's impossible. Finally, they enter the mountain valley, and there it is, right before them. The pass. A narrow gap in two rock walls, so tantalizingly close. But the snow here is already 10 feet deep, and the horses sink to their chests. Wagons bog down. On the other side of that pass is California. Warmth, safety. But they're too late. The snow makes the mountains impassable. They are in a bowl between two mountain ridges. They can't go forward, can't go back. Doors on both sides have slammed shut. The 90 people split into two groups. Eddie's larger group is closer to the pass, along a lake, while the second group, with the Donners, is a couple of miles back. Both groups rush to build shelter. 3 shanty cabins at the lakeside camp and 2 cabins farther back. At the first camp near the lake, William Eddie has built a cabin for his wife and his little son and daughter, and has allowed other stragglers to take shelter there too. These cabins are really just lean-tos covered with hides. Still, the snows come. They quickly realize they don't have enough food to last the winter, and so they start rationing what cattle they have left. Then a blizzard comes, and so much snow falls that the pioneers come out and realize their cows are buried. The pioneers poke sticks in the snow, trying to find their dead cows, but they're just gone. And still the snow falls. The fires in their cabins keep the snow melted around them, and soon they have to build steps up into the snow around their cabins, 20-foot walls of white surrounding their shacks so that all you see is the smoke from their fires. Days pass horribly, desperately. For 2 months they live at the bottom of these snow pits on starvation rations. They try to hunt, but no one can kill any game except William Eddie. Weakened by hunger, he still goes out every day and manages to shoot some rabbits and even a deer. Earlier, the wealthy families wouldn't share their cattle with him, but Eddie shares his meager game with everyone. But even that food is running out as the game moves down from the snow line. Then one day, Eddie comes across tracks. He follows the tracks desperately until he's miles from camp. It's a bear. He catches up to it and raises his rifle weakly, shoots, and hits it. But the bear turns and charges him. He can't reload, and nearly starved to death, he has to fight the bear with his rifle stock. He beats the wounded animal to death with his bare hands. He drags this bear back to the camp, where the people are getting increasingly desperate. William Eddie keeps saying, "We've got to send a team for help." But no one else is strong enough to go, and he's obviously too worried about leaving his family behind to go himself. But now the game has gone down from the mountains, and the snow keeps falling. And finally, one night, he talks with his wife, who begins the film as a quiet woman, someone who has suffered life more than lived it. Now she takes a deep breath. "Willem," she says, "you've got to take those who are strong and go. Get help." He protests, but she says, "For our children, please." What can he do? What if the only way to save the ones you love is to leave them behind? By this time, the pioneers have eaten all of their horses and mules and even their pets. People are making soup out of saddles and blankets and shoe leather, anything to flavor the snow water. William Eddie's family is down to a few scraps of bear meat. He has no choice. He asks for volunteers. By then, only 17 people are strong enough to try. 12 men and boys, and 5 young women. They make crude snowshoes out of harnesses and reins and start out. Right away, 2 of the boys turn back because the snow is too deep. Even with snowshoes, the rest fall 2 feet with every step. Eddie leads his party of 15 away and they struggle. It takes 2 days just to make it to the pass. On the first night, they camp, and Eddie reaches in his pack, and, like a blow to the gut, he realizes his wife has packed the remaining bear meat for him. It's only a few bites, but her selflessness destroys him. She has sacrificed her share for him. He looks back and can just see a curl of smoke from their camp. What if the only way to save the ones you love is to leave them behind? They move on. For days and days, the 15 walk, making slow progress against craggy peaks and snowy valleys. Blizzards blind them and stop them in their tracks. It takes days to go a few thousand yards. With no food except a few bites of Eddie's bear meat, they grow weak. One of the men, Foster, says they must sacrifice one of themselves for food for the others. And they talk of drawing lots. William Eddie says that if someone is going to be sacrificed, then that man must be given a chance. They should pick 2 men and have them fight to the death. He volunteers to be one of the men, but no one moves. One morning, an old man and a boy are dead of starvation. They have no choice. They build a fire and eat the meat of their companions. But we don't linger on this aspect. It's just what it is. People hear Donner Party and they think cannibalism, but almost all of the survivors said the cannibalism was nothing. It was the cold, the despair. These are the enemy. For days, they walk. Only William Eddie keeps them from descending into chaos. More men die, and the party eats what it can. And still, the group walks until there are only 9 left, 4 of the original 10 men and all 5 women. 2 of the surviving men are Indian scouts. The other living white man, Foster, wants to shoot the Indians and eat them. But Eddie won't let him, and he warns the Indians, who manage to escape before Foster can kill them. When Foster finds out, he attacks Eddie, but the women break up the fight. And why do the men die and the women survive? Because women have more body fat to live off of, and are lighter, so they use less energy walking through snow. It is the great irony. Muscles kill men. 18 days. That's how long the rescue party walks. For 18 days, they stagger through 40-foot drifts, ice so hard it cracks their skin. They are 7 skeletons in tatters when they finally descend below the snow line. In the woods, they see a deer, but William Eddie is too weak to lift his gun. It is wrenching. William Eddie finally sees game, tries to shoulder his rifle, and fails. He just drops the gun and walks on. For food, they graze on bark and wild grasses like deer. And then William Eddie sees a curl of smoke from a small Indian village. But the others are simply too weak to move. So William Eddie leaves them behind and goes on himself. Remember, this is before the 49ers and the real boom in California. The state is virtually empty. San Francisco is a town of a few hundred people called Yerba Buena. Now, we're tight on a cabin at the edge of the mountains. We pull back to see it, idyllic and peaceful, a stream running in front, little patches of snow. We go wider and wider, so that you see this is the only civilization for miles. And there, in the corner of the frame, are 2 Indians holding up this figure. Now we go closer again, and we see between the Indians this gaunt creature, practically a skeleton, wild beard, barefoot, his clothes just tattered rags, staggering to the cabin. Is William Eddie? The ranchers get him some water, a bit of flour, which is all his constricted stomach can handle. His eyes well with tears. There are others in an Indian village near here, he tells them. 6. A party is sent off. He's done it. of the 15 who went for help, William Eddy has brought Foster and the 5 women to safety and told the ranchers about the others back in the mountains. But the story's not over. First act, trek into the mountains. Second act, descent and escape. Third act, the rescue. Eddy has left 70 people up in the mountains waiting for help. A rescue party is raised, 40 men led by a fat, smug cavalryman named Colonel Woodworth. Eddy and Foster are too weak to help, but Eddy wakes momentarily in his bed to see dozens of men riding past the frontier cabin. When his fever finally breaks days later, he asks about the rescue party. The ranchers tell him that Woodworth's men are camped only 2 days away, waiting out a snowstorm. A small rescue party of 7 made it back to the Donner Party, but they nearly died crossing the pass, and were only able to bring a dozen or so people out, because of the deep snow and the weakness of the trapped pioneers. Even being rescued was a great danger. Several more died on the way across the mountains. After a long pause, William Eddy speaks. "And my family?" The rancher shakes his head. "I'm sorry. Your wife and daughter were already dead. Your boy is still alive, but was too young to walk over the pass. They left him in the camp." William Eddy rises from his bed. He must go. His old enemy Foster also left a son behind, and he agrees to go with Eddy, even though they are weak still. At a camp miles from the pass, Woodworth tells Eddy a spring snowstorm has made it too dangerous to attempt. But Eddy won't take no for an answer. He offers Woodworth's men $20 for every child they will carry over the pass. A few soldiers agree and they press on, and are nearly killed traversing the pass they've just crossed weeks earlier. Finally, Eddy and Foster and a handful of men stagger back into the Donner camp. It's a scene from hell. Bodies cut up in the snow. Pieces hanging like sausages in a deli. The smell, the despair, gaunt survivors unrecognizable as humans. William Eddy can barely muster the strength to walk to the cabin he built months earlier, where he and Foster left their families. Foster's son is still alive. Foster cries as he holds his boy. But for Eddy, he's too late. His son died days earlier. William Eddy has lost his whole family. He goes into a rage and stands above the villain, Keseberg, who may have eaten the children, this man who is nothing more than an animal. Eddy looks down at this beast. He steps forward to kill the man, but he can't. He falls down and stares at the sky again, at the very sky that dropped that first snowflake on him. And his head goes to his hands. Foster steps forward to kill Keseberg for him, but a voice comes from the heap that is William Eddy. "Leave him," he tells Foster, because Eddy knows that this evil lives in all of us, that we are all animals in the end. "Let him be," he says. William Eddy has simply survived, and as he faces the horizon, we realize that maybe it's all any of us can hope to do. Survive. Caught in the raging cross-currents of history, of sorrow, and of certain death, a man realizes he is powerless, that all his belief in himself is a vanity, a dream. So he does his best. He squirms against the snow and the wind and his own animal hungers, and this is a life. For family, for love, for simple decency, a good man rages against nature and the brutality of fate, but it is a war he can never win. Every love is the same love, and it is overpowering, the wrenching grace of what it is to be human. We love, we try, we die alone. On screen, in this snowy field, we see 150 years pass in 10 seconds, as train tracks come through, then roads are built, then houses, and the first cars begin to ply Truckee Pass on their way to Tahoe, and then an interstate, this once impassable place, now just another stretch of freeway. And we are faced with the cruel ease of today's passage. But we pull up and see the forest, and the truth of humanity remains. These trees, this mountain, the inscrutable face of nature, of death. And as quickly as we saw this freeway, it is gone. A dream, a hallucination, a vision in the destroyed mind of a broken man. It's just a remote mountain pass in the year 1847. The world around him quiet as death. It's dusk. And William Eddy rides out alone. Chapter 8. The Grand Hotel. April 1962. Rome, Italy. Pasquale slept uneasily in an expensive little albergo near the terminal station. He wondered how guests in these Rome hotels slept with all the noise. He rose early, slipped into his pants, shirt, tie, and jacket, had a café, and then took a cab to the Grand Hotel, where the American film people were staying. He smoked a cigarette on the Spanish steps as he prepared himself. Vendors were setting up cut flower stands, and tourists were already flitting about, clutching folded maps, cameras around their necks. Pasquale looked down at the name on the paper that Orencio had given him, and said the name quietly so he wouldn't mess it up. "I am here to see Michael Dean. Michael Dean. Michael Dean." Pasquale had never been inside the Grand Hotel. The mahogany door opened onto the most ornate lobby he'd ever seen. Marble floors, floral frescoes on the ceilings, crystal chandeliers, stained glass skylights depicting saints and birds and glum lions. It was hard to take it all in, and he had to force himself not to gape like a tourist, to appear serious and focused. He had important business with the bastard Michael Dean. People were milling about in the lobby, groups of tourists and Italian businessmen in black suits and eyeglasses. Pasquale didn't see any film stars, but then he wouldn't have known what they looked like either. He rested for a moment against a white sculpted lion, but its face was so much like a human's that it made Pasquale uncomfortable, and he moved on to the front desk. Pasquale moved his hat and handed the desk clerk the piece of paper with Michael Dean's name on it. He opened his mouth to say his line, but the clerk looked at the paper and pointed to an ornate doorway at the end of the lobby. "End of the hall." A long line of people stretched and winded out the doorway where the clerk pointed. "I have business with this man, Dean. He's in there?" he asked the clerk. The man just pointed and looked away. "End of the hall." Pasquale made his way to the back of the line at the end of the hall. He wondered if these people all had business with Michael Dean. Maybe the man had sick actresses squirreled all over Italy. The woman in line in front of Pasquale was attractive. Straight brown hair and long legs, maybe his age, 22 or 23, wearing a tight dress and nervously fingering an unlit cigarette. "Do you have a light?" she asked. Pasquale struck a match and held it for her. She cupped his hand and breathed in. "I'm so nervous. If I don't smoke right now, I'm going to have to eat a whole cake. Then I'll be as fat as my sister, and they'll have no use for me." He looked past her, along the line of people, into an ornate ballroom, big gold pillars in the corners. "What is this line?" he asked. "This is the only way," she answered. "You can try to get in at the studio or wherever they're filming that day, but I think the lines all go to the same place. No, the best way is to do what you did. Just come here." Pasquale said, "I am trying to find this man." He showed her the piece of paper with Dean's name on it. She glanced at the paper and then showed him her own piece of paper, which had the name of a different man on it. "It doesn't matter," she said. "All of the lines lead to the same place eventually." More people fell in line behind Pasquale. The line led to a small table, where a man and a woman were seated with several stapled sheets of paper in front of them. Perhaps the man was Michael Dean. The man and the woman asked each person in line a question or two, and then either sent them back the way they'd come, or to stand in the corner or out another door that seemed to lead outside.